Welcome to the Big Three podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymere Baptist. The Big Three Pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymerebaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome back to the Big Three. It is January 2026, and we've been off for a number of weeks now since before Christmas last year, and relaunching the Big Three for this year, starting with our series that we've done for, 15 years, maybe more or less, Jesus and the Sydney Morning Herald, a series that we do that's quite topical, where we try to address contemporary issues through the lens of theology and faith. And on Sunday, I preached the first of the three sermons in this year's installment and talked a bit about toxic empathy, a phrase that has taken some particular parlance from right-wing evangelical Christian circles in the United States. I'm aware that our political situation in Australia is different than that in the United States. But the idea being that empathy can be toxic if it is used, and the book that I was referring to by Ali Beth Stuckey argues that empathy has been co-opted by the progressive movement in America to manipulate people into accepting their political agenda. And essentially, under five different headings, I suggested that we need to make sure that we leave space for empathy, essentially arguing that empathy is not necessarily toxic, both rhetorically, ethically, developmentally, historically, and theologically. I think we need to leave some space for empathy to make sure that it's part of our decision-making process because of its significance as a strong and powerful and useful emotion. And that's not to suggest that we cannot be manipulated by empathy. We can, but we can be equally manipulated by any number of emotions. And there are some out there in the political sphere in particular. Think about the use of fear or anger. And those are far more toxic than empathy. Nonetheless, if you want to listen to that, you can. But I've got some questions that were raised out of that, and I want to have a bit of a crack at reflecting on them as well, because that's what this is all about. So here we go. Here are the three questions I want to look at. The first is, what are your thoughts on the kind of empathy which considers words or ideas or faith-based beliefs to be violence? Now, as often happens with the Big Three, I sometimes have to kind of work out what I think the question's asking. So for whoever asked the question, I hope I get it right. One of the things that Ali Beth Stuckey talks about in one of the chapters is about the transgender movement, LGBTQ. And one of the little phrases she uses in her introduction to demonstrate toxic empathy is the idea that if you, I don't know if you really care for people, you'll use their pronouns. And so I'm going to kind of go with in that sort of space, that whole thing about, you know, having to utilize certain speech because, you know, to use the kind of the natural pronouns rather than your desired pronouns can be hurtful. So that's where I'm going to go with that. And we'll reflect a bit on that. Secondly, can you comment on any relationship between toxic empathy and tough love? Can we love toughly but with empathy? Hebrews 12:11. And then finally, is toxic empathy a cynical invention to divert Christian voters from feeling they should act and vote compassionately? So I'm looking forward to having a bit of a conversation, continuing this on, and hope that it's helpful as you think through some of the issues that were raised as well. Let's get into it. So as I just said, I'm going to take this first question as speaking about primarily about words that are deemed to be helpful, hurtful, and whether or not we should adopt them. I'm aware that this question, as it's phrased, or at least as I understand it, that's probably a better way to put it, probably leaks a little bit into this coming week's topic, which is navigating free speech. So the question again, what are your thoughts on the kind of empathy which considers words or ideas or faith-based beliefs to be violence? I was thinking about a couple of examples. You know, the one is much more related to free speech, that idea that if I express a belief from scripture that a particular behavior or sexual expression is wrong, for instance, that can be deemed to be hurtful and that I should avoid describing or talking about what I believe the Bible says. And that's more of a free speech thing, I think, in this context. But the other one was the one that I mentioned, the use of pronouns. Ali Beth Stuckey, in her book Toxic Empathy, How Progressives Exploit Christian Compassion, has a number of like one-liners that she uses. They kind of set up the chapters that she has in the rest of the book to talk about some of the policies. And it's, I think, you know, if you genuinely care for people, you'll use their pronouns. And I think that's not a bad place to start. I don't know if that's the example that the questioner this week had in mind, but that's where I want to kind of take some time to reflect, because I think that there are some important elements within that, right? So I think I've had this conversation before about the LGBTQ and the Pride movement. If not, let me restate it. So one of the things that I think has happened, you know, quite frequently is, you know, like in sporting arenas, they'll have like Pride nights, right? And the players might wear a Pride jersey, you know, rainbow jersey or whatever the case is. And inevitably there's someone on the team who's like, I'd rather not. And they tend to get, you know, excoriated in kind of the media and whatnot. And as I was thinking about what would happen if someone asked me to wear a Pride jersey, you know, Division 4 ice hockey in Australia, because that would draw the crowds in, I'm sure. I digress. And I think that my response would depend on what I was being asked to do or what I perceived I was doing. So, for instance, if the wearing of a Pride jersey was to support the inclusion of anyone in the game that I play, if it was to say that regardless of your sexuality or your race or your ethnicity or any, whatever that is, right, you can play hockey. Right? Like if it were all about inclusion, I'd probably be happy to wear a Pride jersey. However, it seems that the way in which it's portrayed in the media when someone says they won't is that what I'm actually doing is I'm affirming the Pride movement and all that it stands for. And if I'm asked to wear a Pride jersey to affirm the movement and all that it stands for, then I'm less comfortable wearing one. And it seems that I think some of the concerns, particularly around LGBTQ issues and whatnot, is related to if I use someone's preferred pronouns, am I affirming the entire worldview that sits beneath it, right? That gender is fluid, that gender is a personal choice, right? That it's an internal reality that may or may not align to my biological gender. Like, am I supporting the entire worldview if I use they, them for someone, right? And so I think that's a fairly important piece to distinguish between when we're thinking about empathy. Because empathy, right? Empathy would say, and I think this is a valid thing, right? This is the power of empathy. Empathy would say, listen, we want people as individuals to feel safe, comfortable, able to be who they are, to express who they are and all those sorts of things. So we should use their pronouns. But I think the unanswered question is, am I supporting the whole thing? And I think as Christians, you know, I think we struggle a little bit, generally speaking, with the idea that gender, for instance, is fluid, or that we control and get to decide, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? So I think that there's a challenge for us there. So I think in empathy, I think we have to be careful about what it is that we're doing. And I think sometimes we have to be aware of the context in which we'd be doing that. So I think at a basic level, you know, my youngest daughter's at university. They are often asked about their preferred pronouns. There are people in her class who have, you know, the they, them, or whatever the case is. And as far as my daughter's concerned, like you just use the pronouns. Like it's easier, and it's, you know, to some degree, she's not making a statement about anything other than like, I see you and I want you to feel comfortable and I will use your preferred pronouns just like I would use your preferred name, right? You prefer to be called your full name rather than a shortened form of it. Great. We'll go with that. Like that's where that sits in empathy. Where I think we do get caught is in that whole piece of by using their pronouns or by, you know, I don't want to say caving because that suggests that, you know, we're doing that the pressure is a bad thing, but where we use words that someone, or we avoid using words that others might consider as violence or as cruel or as hurtful or whatever the case is. When we avoid those terms, are we actually supporting the entire worldview? I think that's where we get a little bit caught. And I think if we can speak about, you know, again, you know, on Sunday, I did draw the line between a political empathy, which is where I think the toxic empathy stuff sits, right? And an interpersonal empathy. Interpersonally, I think we should use people's preferred pronouns and avoid hurtful language. If they find it hurtful, we should just avoid it, right? Like interpersonally, because, well, we just want to be kind people. I don't think that's a huge problem. I think once we're in the political sphere, that becomes a little bit of a different matter, right? We can appreciate and understand how avoiding certain language or using certain language is helpful for people. But there may be political implications that we need to think through a little bit more carefully. So I think that would be my thought. Again, I hope that at least sits somewhere in the ballpark of the question. As I said, I think some of it leaks into the questions around free speech as well. But I think that the delineation between a personal empathy or interpersonal empathy and a political empathy, I think, is an important distinction, as well as trying to figure out what it is that we are doing. I think politically, that's where we would be supporting or not supporting an entire worldview, right? At an interpersonal level, I think there's a different component to it in that. So I hope that's helpful and answers a little bit of the question, or at least helps you think that through a bit more as well. Second question, can you comment on any relationship between toxic empathy and tough love? Can we love toughly but with empathy? I routinely fall back on a Reverend Lovejoy, a character from The Simpsons, answer to a tough question with I can't remember exactly how it goes, but it's, you know, yes with a maybe, no with a but. You know, it's that whole kind of probably a little both ways. I think that we probably can love toughly while still showing empathy. You know, I was thinking a little bit about this question and in particular the idea of tough love. And, you know, the places where I have heard the phrase tough love are often in the context of pretty toxic relationships, right? So, you know, you hear it in relationship to, you know, like family breakdowns where, you know, there may be patterns of, you know, drug abuse, for instance, and you're kind of coming back home and the cycles of, you know, of maybe not violence, but, you know, just the kind of the abuse in the situation, the emotional manipulation, just all the toxicity in that relationship. And that sometimes, I think this is where I've heard it talked about, it's not the only context, but that sometimes tough love is what needs to be done in order not only to protect yourself, but also to actually help someone. Right. I know that in the in social services, right? Sometimes tough love is required in order to genuinely help people rather than appearing to coddle them, those sorts of ideas. And thinking about that context then, you know, made me just got me thinking a little bit more about where empathy sits in that space. In the contexts where we require tough love, I mean, we are talking about, the perspective of the sermon or the stance of the sermon, politically speaking, that's a difficult position to hold, right? You know, politically speaking, can we demonstrate love of any sort politically, right? But tough policies can still demonstrate empathy and can demonstrate compassion as well in the midst of that. And again, as I said on Sunday, you know, Brené Brown talks about empathy as a tool for compassion. It kind of shapes the and focuses the kind of compassion that we bring. So I think... I think in order to have the combination of tough love and empathy, which I think is a good thing, because again, I think tough love is seeking to bring about the good of the person whom we love, right? And so therefore is essentially a function of compassion. And if it's a function of compassion, then we do need empathy, right? But sometimes, you know, that empathy needs to go beyond what someone says they feel, right? To kind of looking at the condition that they might have or the wider structures and systems that are shaping the situation. So I think we can have tough love and empathy. I think they're important to hold together. Again, obviously, in any situation where you are seeking to demonstrate tough love, you know, in particularly in its, I'm not sure its purest form, but in terms of its in terms of what it actually says it is, tough love, that is a remarkably difficult place to be, isn't it? Where you are trying to demonstrate genuine, authentic love for someone, but that love needs to bring with it some toughness, right? So you think about, you know, I suppose a simple example of that to some degree is, you know, parental discipline of their children, right? You know, parental discipline is a really important principle, right? The exact form that discipline might take varies over time and spaces and in just different contexts, but the principle of discipline is really important. And it means that there are certain things that we do that are going to be are going to be perceived of as tough or difficult or hard, right? That aren't going to be a lot of fun for anybody, really, but are really, really important. Now, I think that, again, you think about that situation, you want to make sure that as a parent, you're not reacting out of your own, just out of your own anger. You want to make sure that you're consistent, right? And that, you know, you are doing this for the good of your children, right? And so that means that you do have to take into consideration, you know, what's going on there, right? I think we've all been in situations, if you're a parent or a teacher or anyone who deals with people and someone's done something that is against the rules or kind of outside of the norm or the expectations, and then you listen to why they've done it. And that might change the way in which you respond. You know, I think that, you know, we want to be providing those boundaries and discipline, but we do also want to be listening, right? And working with, because ultimately the issue is not the tough love, it's the outcome of that tough love, right? We want our children, for instance, to become, well, functional adults, right? We want them to be people who recognize boundaries and authorities and have some self-discipline and control in their own lives and can moderate themselves and their behavior in life and do well. And so that big goal, I think, plays a part in that as well. So, yeah, I think we can show empathy and tough love. Obviously, you know, that is a difficult, it can be a difficult place to be. And I know that, you know, simple parental discipline, I mean, it's not always simple, but simple parental discipline is one thing. Really toxic situations is another, where tough love becomes really, really hard. And you are seeking to care for yourself as well as those who are involved. All of those things are really complex. But I do think, again, we want to leave a little bit of space for empathy. Not as the only decision, not as the only emotion that we refer to, all that kind of stuff. But I think, yes, we can indeed and should keep empathy in those circumstances. Final question today is this. Is toxic empathy a cynical invention to divert Christian voters from feeling they should act and vote compassionately? The only thing I would question in that question is whether we can assert and describe a motivation. Is it cynical? On Sunday when I spoke about this, I started by talking about rhetoric. the art and science of persuasion, because we're talking about the political sphere where we're basically seeking to persuade people about a particular policy or a particular way forward. Persuasion becomes fairly important. And in rhetorical theory, there are three types of proofs. There's the proofs of ethos, which are the gentle proofs that are found in the speaker themselves, like, do you trust me? Logos, which is kind of, shall we say, the rationale for the decision. And then pathos, the strong emotions. And I observe that, you know, emotion is necessary and needful to cause people to act. And so the idea of stirring the emotions is not in and of itself manipulation. It's actually a really key part of inspiring and persuading people of something. And so I'm hesitant to remove empathy off the board in terms of legitimate emotions that we can appeal to in a political space. I think to say that no, empathy is no good, if you appeal to empathy, that's an invalid argument. Is it in itself invalid? I think that's the point. That's the point I was trying to make. Which does, of course, raise the question then about the viability of a position that doesn't allow empathy. In Ali Beth Stuckey's book, she has this lengthy introduction where she talks about toxic empathy, and then she has a series of chapters that are focused on particular policies that she believes that the progressive left have exploited Christian compassion in, you know, abortion and the LGBT conversation, immigration, social justice, those sorts of things. I only read the first one because I wasn't particularly interested in exploring all of those policies in the sermon itself. And so I read the first chapter, which was on abortion, and I noted that she appeals to emotion there. She appeals in particular to, I guess, what I would call disgust, in terms of her description of particularly late-term abortions and the way in which that impacts both the unborn child and the parent. And so she appeals to that, and she does it quite effectively, rhetorically speaking, because it's indirect. Right? I don't think she ever actually says this is horrifying or this is disgusting. She just describes it, and that's how a good pathos appeal works, right? It's an indirect appeal where the emotions are stirred by the description of what's taking place. So she's not afraid of using that kind of an emotional appeal, right? Which I think is like good on her. Like that's how this whole thing works. But it does raise the question for me about saying, so if in a debate, if I appeal to empathy and the response is no, I don't believe that empathy is a good emotion here, I'm not convinced that necessarily undermines emotion or undermines empathy. I think there needs to be a stronger appeal. I think, as I said, it might have been in the evening service. It might have been in the morning. I can't remember now. But I think, you know, the ideas that we believe we hold as Christians, we believe they're actually really good for people, right? And that if we, you know, that, shall we say, when we really truly understand people and they truly understand what God desires for them, those things match up, right? So I think that we ought to be able to listen to people and listen to their experiences and apply the gospel to those situations because we believe that the gospel is indeed good, good news. So I think my short answer to this question is toxic empathy, a cynical invention to divert Christian voters from feeling they should act and vote compassionately. I would say yes. I don't know that it's always cynical. It feels to me like it is based a little bit on the idea that we can't seem to beat empathy, right? Empathy seems to be a bit of a trump card. Empathy seems to be something that, you know, really moves people to consider compassionate policies. I think that instead of saying that we have to take empathy off the board, I think we need to have better arguments for the positions that we might hold. Because if our opponent can use empathy and, shall we say, always win the debate, denying their use of empathy is not an effective argument. I think that's kind of where I sit on that space. So it does feel a little bit like saying, yeah, it's no good. Now, at the same time, I should, you know, in the sense of being in fairness, when empathy or any emotion is used to manipulate people, that should be drawn attention to, right? It should be drawn attention to. And I think that there are some components of what Ali Beth Stuckey has to say in terms of the oversimplified versions, right, that I think make some sense. So she, I mentioned in the last question or the first question, you know, if you truly care for people, you use their pronouns. That sentence acts as a catch-all for the whole LGBTQ conversation, which you have to say is not a particularly helpful way to summarize such a large and complex issue. There are some really complicated pieces. And I think that one of the challenges in our day and age is the whole, you know, policies by social media, where people put out, like, you know, a paragraph or two to state their position on something that's super, super complicated. And everything gets boiled down to slogans. And slogans are really, I mean, they're helpful because they boil things down, but they're not really helpful for discussion and debate. And they tend to be used now in discussion and debate. And therefore, there's not a lot of room for nuance. And so things like empathy, which I think invite nuance in particular, don't really have a space. And so when it gets boiled down to if you care, you will, then that can feel like we're being painted into a corner, that I can't do anything about it. But we have to be better at expanding the conversation and paying more attention to some of the nuance and details within it. Those would be my thoughts on it. I think that we have to be, you know, equally careful. I think I put it this way. If the whole idea about, you know, the whole, if you care for people, use their pronouns, if that summarizes a whole position on the left, we have to be equally careful of the position that empathy is toxic if you end up feeling that progressive positions are correct. Like, that is equally reductionist and equally unhelpful in that context. And so I do think it becomes shorthand for, yeah, don't vote for things that are compassionate, because that's how that slogan ends up working, right? It ends up kind of painting things very black and white. And so whenever there's an appeal to empathy, I kind of go, well, that's obviously toxic in this political context and I must cut it off. And again, the point of what I was trying to get at on Sunday is I think we need to leave space in our political discourse for empathy. It's not the only emotion that we need to leave space for. And it's not the kind of the final emotion that we need to leave space for, but we need to leave space for it in order that we might come up with, I think, some policies, some ways forward as a community at large that are indeed good for people, because we've actually listened to people and looked at the complexity that we find within it. Anyway, I hope that's helpful. Thank you for those who asked those questions. And again, trust that my meanderings and ramblings about that has kind of helped move you forward a little bit in that conversation. I think it's so important that we have opportunities to practice thinking about these sorts of social issues in the context of faith. On Sunday, as I said, we're going to be looking at free speech, navigating free speech, an issue that's particularly prominent for us in Australia at the moment, because of the soon-to-be-released legislation on hate speech in particular. It's not the same as free speech, but it kind of links in there as well. And so there's a whole bunch of stuff that's kind of bubbling to the surface about what can be said, what should not be said, how do we navigate those sorts of those things. And it's been interesting as a preacher preparing for that with kind of a continual news feed dripping things out. So I hope you can join us either on site or online this Sunday as we continue to explore some social topics, some hot topics from the perspective of faith and theology. And hope you can join me again next week for the Big Three. Until then, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big Three podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are the Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Guymere Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.